You are listening to North Shore Community Radio, broadcasting at 90.7 FM WTIP Grand Marais, 90.1 FM WGPO Grand Portage, 89.1 FM WKEK Gunflint Lake, and on the web at WTIP.org. Stay tuned, a special community conversation is coming up next.
Good evening. Welcome to Conversations on Health and Well-Being, a series of interviews exploring rural health and well-being. I'm Kristen DiRuta-Wharton, your host this evening. Tonight, I'm really excited to share with you two of my recent conversations. First, I'll talk with Dr. Kate Shafto, an integrative physician at the University of Minnesota and M Health System, in an interview that I'm calling Food as Medicine. If you don't know what an integrative physician is, stick around and you'll find out. In the second half of the hour, we'll talk with Will Wilson of the Minnesota Department of Health about hot topics in rural health, including rural obstetric closures, and why now is the time for rural citizens to speak up for our rural hospitals and clinics. But first up this evening, food as medicine. Dr. Kate Shafto is a physician who believes that literally, you are what you eat. Dr. Shafto uses an approach to healthcare called food as medicine. In addition to her work with patients, she also teaches a course for medical and health professional students at the U of M called Food Matters. Dr. Shafto and her colleague, Chef Jenny Breen, taught a version of the Food Matters course to Cook County health providers in August of 2017, which kicked off my friendship and mentorship with Dr. Shafto. In January 2018, I joined Dr. Shafto at the M Health Primary Care Clinic on the campus of the U of M, and after clinic, we recorded this interview.
So, hi, Kate.
Hello.
I want to thank you so much for allowing me to learn with you today and agreeing to speak on recording.
Yes, my pleasure.
I'm really excited to have had the opportunity today to learn more about your integrative medicine practice here at the university.
Thanks.
And I'd love for you to just tell me a little bit more about yourself and your work, what you do here at the university, and kind of how you ended up here, what your path was.
Great question. So my name is Kate Shafto, and I am a physician trained in the typical route. I got my MD degree from the University of Nebraska. Then I did my residency in both internal medicine and pediatrics, what we call the double major of residency options. And it also goes by the specialty called med-peds. And so I did 4 years of residency in Illinois and trained in both of those disciplines and took my boards in each one. And then practiced in Minnesota, first out of residency with Health Partners for several years as a hospitalist. So I saw patients only in the hospital setting, both children and adults who were sick enough to be admitted to the hospital. And I realized through that several years of work that I was passionate about teaching and wanted to get back to some opportunities in teaching. And I was able to find a position here at the university in 2012. So what is this now, 2018? 5.5 years later, my career has changed significantly from starting out as a hospitalist here as well. And the benefit to being at the university was that I had a lot of access to students and residents and people at various levels of training in medicine as well as other fields of healthcare. And I enjoyed being around learners and quickly got involved in medical student education in the early years before they're in the clinical setting, as well as interacting with medical students on my teams in the hospital setting. So that's what drew me here to the university.
And what drew you to medicine to begin with?
So stories go around my family that I, from an early age, wanted to take care of people. My grandfather was a doctor, and he was a very typical family doctor who had trained during, must have been the 40s, and had gone through medical training very quickly because of the war. And so he had been in the military, did his training, never ended up in service out of the U.S., but then became a doctor in the community where he lived in Maryland. And I remember him making house calls and seeing patients at the nursing home, and he had his own practice with one office assistant who was not full-time and kept his own charts, and that was my knowledge of what a doctor did.
Wow.
And I really respected that, and he was well-respected in our community as well, and that stood out to me, and it made an impression on me. And I think sometime in high school I started becoming interested in the healthcare system. I didn't really have any particular interaction personally with the healthcare system because we would usually see my grandfather if we were sick. But I ended up volunteering at a hospital in high school a couple times, and worked at a group home at some point along the way. And so I was just in contact in various capacities with people who were in need of some sort, either mental or physical health needs.
So it sounds like that human relationships and and that kind of humanity and health and appealed to you.
I think it did, and I see that as what initially led me into the field, and I think increasingly I see my role as an educator, and that's motivating and draws me to continue to educate patients, to educate the learners that I'm around here at the university. And I was told by a chiropractor, I worked at a chiropractic office along the way too, I was told that by this chiropractor that I worked with that doctor means teacher, somewhere in the roots of the word. And so I think that holds true to be a healer as well, but a teacher.
Yeah. I share that with you as well, and that's, you know, definitely in the nursing tradition.
Yes.
and nurse practitioners as well are very much steeped in that educator role.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it has become something that I have put the word around, empowering. So that's what I think I strive to do with my patients, is to empower them to understand the way their body was put together and how it works and how best to take care of it.
So tell us a little bit about what does the term integrative medicine mean, and how is that differentiated from conventional medicine or non-integrative medicine?
Yeah. So integrative medicine, as I experience it, practice it, and as it's been defined to me, is a whole person approach to healing with a real focus on healing and not a focus on sickness. I've also heard it said that our healthcare system is not at all a health care system, but a sick care system. And that maybe is the difference with conventional medicine, which is specifically called allopathic medicine, or a Western approach, has very much a disease-focused mentality and approach. Our training is very much to recognize diseases when they appear, and to find or know the drug or procedure or surgery that's indicated to address those symptoms or those diseases. And integrative medicine is a much more holistic approach that involves what a person eats, the way that they sleep, move, their family, their history, their physical body. I consider a part of integrative medicine also the environment that they live in, what they've been exposed to, and then the emotional, social, spiritual aspects of a person's life. And so those things all factor into the way that I approach a patient now with my integrative medicine training.
And I appreciated being able to have a visual of seeing what that looks like today. And I know that for myself, I've been feeling like I'm starting to pull together threads of what I, you know, hope that my practice looks like in the future as a nurse practitioner. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I have identified in my mind is that, but I didn't know how it looked yet, was before I came to see you today, was that I knew that I wanted people to leave their time with me feeling good in some way, like physically feeling good. And I was able to see you do some of that today with people, just with your rapport with them, but also teaching them about breathing techniques and actually kind of going through that with them. And that was really nice to see.
Well, thank
you. So thank you.
Good.
What about food as medicine? You came up to Grand Marais last summer, which was fantastic, and taught I think like 30 healthcare professionals mm-hmm. in our community, doctors, nurses, dentists, you know.
Mental health professionals.
Right. Mm-hmm. About this concept of food as medicine. Mm-hmm. What does that mean in a nutshell?
Great little pun
in a
there.
Walnut
a
shell.
Nutshell. Yeah, I love it. So food as medicine has become a bit of a trendy term. There's a conference called Food as Medicine. I'm sure there's books about it. It's a very old concept dating back to Hippocrates, who is known to be the father of medicine. And his quote is said to be, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." And to me, that means, in a non-allopathic sense, meaning not to wait until a disease has appeared and then treat it with food, but rather let food be thy health, maybe is a better say. Is let food be what keeps you well and keeps diseases away. But so many people come to me with existing disease, diabetes, obesity, cholesterol problems, gastrointestinal problems, mental health concerns, that I do use food to treat those diseases or those conditions. We use food to improve digestion, to reduce inflammation, to improve cognition and alertness and energy. And so in that sense, it does function as a medicine, so to speak, but a lot better than the pills that are produced by pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, and we all have to eat. We all eat anyway.
We all
you were
eat
saying
anyway.
This earlier.
Yes,
we're
we
gonna
all have
eat,
to eat.
So, yeah.
And it's so powerful because we eat 3 or more times per day, and that is something that is so frequent and so vital to our existence that, therefore, what we eat has such tremendous potential to influence our health. We're interacting with it so frequently, and we require it for life.
Well, I certainly share your that value that mm-hmm. food has that quality about it, important for our health. And mm-hmm. But it's, you know, when I was in nursing school, I took a 2-credit undergraduate class on personal nutrition, and it was a good class, but that was it. And even in my nurse practitioner program, mm-hmm. there's not any specific nutritional guidance or course. But I heard you today talking about things that were a lot more practical mm-hmm. in some sense, you know, providing recipes for people, mm-hmm. talking to them about what types of fats, for example, mm-hmm. are healthy fats, people asking you questions about is organic actually, you know, all that it's cracked up to be mm-hmm. for their health. And so could you tell me a little bit about how you came to this place that you have this knowledge base about food as medicine, that you're able to meet with people on this topic?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So I started out quite literally going to the conference called Food as Medicine. It wasn't the first one I'd been to around nutrition, but another conference I went to was Healthy Kitchens, Healthy Lives, which trains health professionals of all disciplines in cooking and food, and that sparked a passion that I didn't know existed in me to incorporate food and cooking even in my practice of healthcare. And so through those conferences, I was led to then doing more research of my own, reading more. I've read several books on clinical nutrition. And then ultimately when I did my fellowship in integrative medicine, there was extensive training around nutrition and very practical nutrition. Certainly the nuts and bolts of fats, proteins, and carbohydrates, and vitamins, and minerals, and certainly the role of supplements, but the emphasis in my training was on whole food nutrition. And then through the course of developing a class that we call Food Matters, which we adapted for the Grand Marais team, I learned a lot through preparing for that class that now I share with a chef, Jenny Breen, and we co-teach that class for health professional students here at the university. And so that has been both a teaching and learning experience for me.
That's fantastic. So while people like you and I didn't receive that kind of mm-hmm. training in our, you know, in our coursework,
yeah.
and
no,
that
it was
sort of
absent
thing,
from my training.
It sounds like you are now a part of making that available
yes,
for
trying.
Students. And what different health disciplines mm-hmm. take that or are open yeah. to taking
it's
a
open
class
to
here
all,
at the U?
Yeah, it's open to all graduate students in healthcare professions. We piloted the class with a group of medical students, and so some medical students continued to take the class, and then graduate-level nursing students in all different fields of nursing and levels of master's and doctoral programs. We've had health coaching students regularly take the class. We've had some counseling students, some graduate-level counseling students, which has been fantastic. Pharmacy students, public health students. I think that kind of covers the gamut.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
It's really fun.
It's really wonderful.
It's super fun to have all of them together, too. See
yeah.
the different perspectives that come out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So to kind of illustrate mm-hmm. what you've been talking about the difference between integrative medicine and allopathic mm-hmm. medicine, or kind of identifying problems and trying to fix them, mm-hmm. I was wondering if you would kind of walk us through briefly like a common digestive disorder, whether, you know, we talked today with people about constipation, mm-hmm. reflux, mm-hmm. just poor digestion in mm-hmm. general, and I know that those are things that many people that I love and are close to me
yes.
deal with.
Yeah, it's super common.
So I was wondering if you could tell us about, you know, kind of what would be the allopathic or conventional mm-hmm. medical approach to that,
yep.
and then how does an integrative approach differ? What do you offer as an integrative doctor?
Fantastic question. I love it. This is a great question. Super fun. So the allopathic approach, what I was trained in my medical school and residency, was for constipation or for reflux, which is often also termed heartburn commonly, or gastroesophageal reflux disease, which goes by the abbreviation GERD, we would give a medication. So that would be the first order of business. So for constipation, some sort of a laxative, some sort of a fiber supplement. For the reflux or heartburn, most likely an acid reducing medication. The integrative approach would zoom way back and ask a lot of questions about diet, about how the person is going about their day, what kind of environment are they eating in? Are they eating on the run? Are they just eating for fuel, not for pleasure, enjoyment, nourishment? The types of foods that they're eating, and then also to ask about medications. Of course, I do a full like medical history review in my patient interactions, so I know what medications my patients are on and what procedures and other diagnoses they've had. And so assessing the big picture in terms of diet, beverages, medications, habits, how much exercise, how much sleep. Because the key thing about the digestive system is that it is governed by a part of our nervous system called the parasympathetic nervous system, also known as the rest and digest nervous system, which is in contrast to the fight or flight nervous system, which is revved up when we're anxious or stressed. And when our anxious and stressed nervous system is on, our rest and digest system cannot be on, which leads to a lot of digestive problems that people are suffering from. And all that's needed is really to take a deep breath, like a deep belly breath, not a big shoulder shrug type of breath, but a big deep belly breath. And a few of those before a meal can tremendously reduce reflux and heartburn, because it prepares a digestive system to start moving forward instead of getting stalled out or going the wrong direction. And that rest and digest nervous system is deeply connected to our breathing. And so that deep breath stimulates the nerves that come through into our digestive system from the brain and make that whole system run well. In addition, I would say, aside from that physical practice and awareness or mindful awareness of the environment in which a person eats and the way in which they eat, I would also try to clean out the things that don't help our digestive system. Artificial sweeteners, soda of all kind, especially diet, regular is just as bad. Alcohol can be tough on the digestive system as well. The antacid drugs that I used to prescribe for reflux and heartburn, they do decrease the acid, yes, but it's kind of a temporizing measure. It doesn't really get to the root of the problem. And so often that weakens the digestive effort or strength, so the digestive juices are less strong, which leads to more indigestion lower down and can even be a contributor to constipation. So I try to identify maybe foods that are causing more reflux, try to develop good, healthy practices of eating that would minimize reflux and eliminate the insults to the digestive tract. And then eating a diet of plenty of vegetables, especially cooked vegetables, which are excellent for vitamin absorption, fiber, nourishment, and they're more pleasurable to eat also, especially when cooked well. So the two recipes that I gave to almost every patient today were roasted vegetables and sauteed greens, and they are a firm foundation for a healthy vegetable-based diet.
People really liked those. They were very excited about those recipes. Mm-hmm. And I think we have them even on hand at the clinic in Grand Marais, yes, from your course.
Exactly. They're barely even recipes. They're more just instructions with a few ingredients. Mm-hmm. So I would try those approaches to digestion issues, either reflux or constipation, which are often related, interestingly, because if the bowels aren't moving out, then it means that things might back up, mm-hmm, and cause reflux to be more likely. And then many people are magnesium deficient, which is super common in our culture, and especially for people who are eating a pretty low variety, low plant-based, and if so, even if they are eating a lot of vegetables and they're conventionally raised, the soil has been so depleted of magnesium and other minerals because of conventional agriculture that many people are magnesium deficient. The WHO estimates that 70% or more of Americans are magnesium deficient. Hmm. Magnesium blood tests don't really tell the whole story because it's only 1% of our whole body magnesium and very tightly regulated in the blood system, bloodstream. So blood tests don't really do the job, but symptoms of constipation, restless sleep, headaches, poor digestion, blood pressure issues, anxiety, depression, menstrual cramps, those are all indications of magnesium deficiency.
I wanted to ask you also about something that I heard you speak to several people about with digestive issues, and that was you recommended apple cider vinegar.
Yes, thank you.
Could you say a little, mm-hmm, bit about that too?
Absolutely. So one of the best ways to start the day in terms of your digestion is a tall glass of water with a splash of apple cider vinegar with the mother. That's the important part of the apple cider vinegar, meaning that mother of the culture, the fermentation process is present. So that's the stringy stuff that's in the apple cider vinegar. Don't strain that out.
The cloudiness.
Yeah,
the stuff at the bottom.
It's important. So 1 tablespoon, say, of apple cider vinegar in a tall glass of water, and then also of lemon juice. That's in many, many old traditions of Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine, that's known as a kind of cleansing tonic for the liver and the digestive system. And it really can calm down reflux, it can quiet down nausea, and stimulate hunger. So starting the morning, first thing, right out of bed with that is a really great way to start up the digestive system.
So before a person would eat,
yes,
they would perhaps try this tonic.
Yep. Yep.
And then do some breathing.
Yes.
To engage that
digestive system. Yes.
The digestive, mm-hmm, system. And then eat their plants and,
yes,
healthy fats. And
yes, absolutely.
Yep.
And so for breakfast, I recommend avoiding simple carbohydrates, avoiding cereals, and having eggs, beans, some fat in either like an avocado or the oils that you're cooking in butter. If you do a cereal of some sort, making it as very, very whole grain as possible, or even leftover wild rice, leftover quinoa, leftover brown rice, or another whole grain, can make a nice breakfast cereal. Steel cut oats, and putting in tons of nuts and seeds to boost the fiber and the fat protein content.
Yum.
I know, sounds good, right?
Well, I think you and I are have earned a meal
We're
here.
Hungry. Yes.
Well, thanks so much for sharing with us on the recording, and thanks so much for allowing me to come and learn with you today.
It was a pleasure.
It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Next up is a conversation with Will Wilson that I'm calling the Golden Rule, because we met in Mr. Wilson's office in the Golden Rule building, and also because public health is all about the philosophy of the Golden Rule. Will Wilson is a supervisor and rural health advocate in the Office of Primary Care and Rural Health at the Minnesota Department of Health in St. Paul. On a chilly January morning, I met Mr. Wilson in his office in the Golden Rule building. The large former department store is now filled with desks of the Minnesota Department of Health office workers. The desks are filled with the good people who do the behind-the-scenes work to protect and promote public health. Join me now for this conversation about the behind-the-scenes work of the Office of Primary Care and Rural Health, statewide perspectives on rural birth closures, and why now is the time to advocate for rural health clinics and critical access hospitals.
So good morning, Will. Thanks for agreeing to meet with me here. We're at the in your office at the Minnesota Department of Health, the Golden Rule building, mm-hmm. which is a pretty cool building and a great name and philosophy
yeah.
for this yeah. Department of Health to be located within.
Mm-hmm. It used to be a department store called the Golden Rule.
Really?
That's why the big atrium in the middle of the building is wide open. And yeah, but it is. It's a great name, and glad you could come down, and thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you. So I'm really interested today to just learn more from you about how the Minnesota Department of Health is involved with this state and national issue of rural obstetric closures in communities like ours in Grand Marais and the North Shore, but we also know that this is kind of a national trend, so I'm really excited to learn more about your thoughts and how the Department of Health is thinking about this or yeah. viewing it.
Sounds good. Happy to talk about what we're doing.
Would you just share a little bit about the Department of Health and what it is? And I think some people that work with these programs probably know what they are, but for an average person off the street who maybe has no idea, mm-hmm. how would an average Minnesotan in the living out in the boondocks mm-hmm. know the work of the Department of Health?
So the Department of Health is our state's public health agency. And that means that we look at the conditions and environment and policies that create health in a broad sense. And that can be everything from epidemiology. I mean, when you hear in the news reports about a flu outbreak or something, those are Department of Health folks. We also regulate facilities. In our office, in the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, our mission is about making sure that we can maintain access to quality healthcare services throughout the state. And so we look at healthcare issues in rural areas in particular, especially the safety net, to make sure that we have a functioning and strong safety net for healthcare services in as many communities as we possibly can.
So you mentioned the Office of Primary Care and Rural Health. And can you tell us a little bit more about your role here at the Department of Health with that department and kind of just a little bit about yourself, how you came to be here?
Sure. The Office of Rural Health and Primary Care we receive a federal grant that kind of defines some of the work that we do. We do things like we define shortage areas in the state, and we have a large suite of grant programs and loan forgiveness programs, and that's really my role. I'm the supervisor of the grants unit. So most of the programs where state and federal dollars are going out into the community go through our office. How I got into this, I lived overseas for a while. And I grew up in Duluth, and after college went overseas for a while and realized that I wanted to be connected to policy more directly. When I was there, I couldn't vote. I couldn't, do anything like that. And so I came back here and started to get active in policy and ended up working at the legislature. My job there ended up being a committee administrator for the Health Policy Committee. And this was for a rural legislator. So I got a really good sense of some of the issues that are facing rural hospitals and rural clinics and public health. And became interested in it, and now I've been in this role for about 5.5 years, and I love it. It's a chance to make sure that the limited resources that we have on the state are, you know, spread out equitably and where the need is the greatest.
So it sounds like you're saying that there are grant programs to help rural communities have access to primary care and health care. Is that something that there's a need for? Are rural communities in a different situation that requires that extra funding?
Definitely. Rural communities are, especially with health care, I think it's a different model in rural health. One of the things that I like to say is that in urban areas, there's probably enough services. The challenge is coordination, and making sure that you're not duplicating efforts or that you're getting people access to the right level of care. In rural areas, coordination happened decades ago because there's only so many providers there. That's not really the issue. The issue in rural areas is maintaining the services and making sure that there's enough access to these services. And so that's really what we do with a lot of our grant programs. We have programs that fund infrastructure in rural hospitals. We fund planning projects. We also, as I mentioned, have a loan forgiveness program that is now funding about 300 individuals throughout the state in various communities and from various professions who are receiving student loan forgiveness in exchange for working in an underserved community.
And why is that? Is that because you need an incentive to work in a rural community, or because the pay is less, or what's the rationale behind that program?
Some of both. I think it's a decision that somebody coming out of school, a physician coming out of school with $250,000 in debt, is going to look at where they can make money to pay that debt off. It's a huge concern for them. And so creating this incentive for them to go and work in an underserved area works. It works to make sure that there is access to services and that providers are available to deliver those services. But we've also found that with the loan forgiveness program, once people move to a community and they stay there for 3 years or 4 years, they tend to settle there more frequently. So they stay and they become a part of the community. That's really the great benefit of that program.
Up in our community, there's a lot of different healthcare access issues, in Grand Marais and the tip of the Arrowhead. And this is just one of them, but one that's kind of near and dear to my heart and the work that I do is in 2015, our local hospital, a critical access hospital, had to make the call to end elective birthing services. And so while the ER remains available for emergencies, there are no longer any planned births happening in our hospital in Grand Marais. And if you're from Duluth, you're familiar with the geography.
Oh, yeah.
So you know that it's a long road, and there's places, in Grand Portage or even where I live, there's definitely places where it's a 3-hour drive from a person's home to a birthing hospital in Duluth. And I'm just curious if you're aware of the situation or MDHs and kind of what your thoughts might be about that.
We are. It's something that we hear systemically and also individually from hospitals that call us and ask us about, what they can do to maintain the service. Birthing services are unfortunately becoming more regional. And there's consolidation of that service in sort of regional centers. And that's a problem. And it's not just for Grand Marais. I mean, Grand Marais is really a clear example of why this is a problem, because if it takes 3 hours to get to a hospital that's just not workable, and it creates a huge amount of difficulty for young families and for communities. And when we hear from hospital leadership, hospital administrators or board members that call and ask us about what they can do to maintain the service, they don't want to get rid of the service because they want to make sure that they can provide it for their community. It's a complex. There are economics involved. There are, economies of scale. It's a difficult service to maintain in an area that has low volume because it's very expensive to maintain both the workforce and also the equipment and processes and everything that you need. we are very aware of it, and we're trying to address it in ways sort of specific and more broadly as well. We can get into some of that if you'd like.
Sure, yeah. So you mentioned that it's not just Grand Marais in this situation, and I know in the northern part of the state, I've talked to people in areas like Boys Fort and Cook, and even over in the Kuchiching area, it sounds like they're now struggling to maintain the service that they have. Do you know, can you tell us about other areas of the state that are experiencing this kind of issue?
Yes. The Health Economics Program here in the Department of Health just recently published a report that looked at the hospitals between 2000 and 2015 that eliminated birthing services in the hospital. And there were about 20 of them.
Wow.
And in 11 of those cases, that meant that the county that the hospital is in lost birthing services completely.
Hmm.
So it's a huge problem throughout the state. And, you know, for communities that are experiencing this, it really is concerning on so many levels because they look to their hospital as you know, the place where they get care. And to have to plan around, you know, traveling 30, 40, 50, 60, in some cases 100 miles to give birth is really a difficult decision for communities to make. So yeah, this is, it's affecting the whole state, and there are a lot of different reasons why. I mentioned in rural areas that it tends to be a low volume and high cost service, but I think workforce is really one of the key drivers to this, that it's really hard to find trained workforce to deliver birthing services and maintain them. And so it's something that we're trying to work on through a bunch of different ways to make sure that rural areas still have access to the workforce to be able to do this. But it's a problem.
Hmm. So it sounds like it's definitely a statewide issue. And then in 2016, a team of researchers from the University of Minnesota published a paper about these rural obstetric closures in hospitals, and their information found that over 80% of rural counties in the United States are now lacking a local birthing option. So it sounds like it's not just Grand Marais, and it's not even just Minnesota, it's a national issue.
Correct, it is. It's, you know, I mentioned the health economics report that just came out. That actually didn't even include, because it went up to 2015, it didn't include Grand Marais.
Okay, or Ely then either.
Or Ely.
They closed in that same year.
Correct. So it's a problem that's continuing. And we hear from hospital leadership who are trying to maintain the service, but just finding it really hard to do so.
Hmm. Okay, and so you mentioned that there's some strategies that you have in mind, and I recognize, as you said, that this is a very complex issue. It is not like there's one fix, and certainly in every community that I've spoken with, there's different circumstances leading to the closure, but there does seem to be kind of a consensus of, you know, maybe eight factors or something like that, half a dozen things that are involved. So what do you have in mind, or what is the Department of Health starting to see as some potential strategies?
So some good news. Minnesota has better healthcare infrastructure than a lot of states. We have 78 critical access hospitals, and these are hospitals that are rural. They're generally smaller, fewer than 25 beds, and they get paid in a different way, where they get actually paid at the cost of the services delivered, and that helps them to maintain access and make sure that they can keep their doors open. We also have a network of rural health clinics. There are about 90 of them throughout the state that can provide primary care. And, you know, up in the northeast part of the state, you've got a federally qualified health center there. We also have some of those in rural areas. So we have really good infrastructure that's in place. I think the challenge is to make sure that these hospitals can afford to and continue to provide birthing services. It's a challenge. Like you mentioned, there are multiple factors. I mentioned workforce as one of them. I think the economics of rural healthcare, while we have the critical access hospital system in place, It doesn't mean that these critical access hospitals can provide every service.
Yeah.
You know, they have to really prioritize what their communities want and need, and then try it as best they can to provide those services for them. There are also issues with independent hospitals versus system-owned hospitals. Sometimes a system-owned hospital will look at a regional model for providing certain services that can impact a local community. And independent hospitals can really struggle because they might not have some of the resources that a system can bring them, such as, you know, providing workforce on a short-term basis or access to capital. So, yeah, some of the other strategies that we're looking at, I mentioned our loan forgiveness program. That helps tremendously to make sure that there's a sort of a core set of providers in some of these areas. One other thing that was mentioned in a report that we published in 2013 that was sort of a footnote in that report, but it's changed since, and that's telemedicine. In 2013, there weren't a lot of examples out there, but now there are a lot more uses of the technology in very specific ways. And one way is a lot of hospitals have access now to sort of telemedicine on demand for the emergency room.
Yeah, and our local hospital has just started that service up, yeah.
It can be wonderful because then you've got, at the push of a button, a screen pops up and you have a physician who's specializes in emergency medicine. In some cases, they'll have a nurse who can document as well. And that means that the hospital can staff an emergency room with, let's say, maybe a family medicine physician, and who isn't necessarily specifically trained in emergency medicine, but they have the support there to be able to feel comfortable, managing an emergent situation. That's really important, I think, because that gives hospitals and clinics a connection to expertise that they would normally have to hire themselves. And so I think we're excited about what that means in the future. There are new models popping up everywhere for different types of services. And I think as that evolves, we'll look for ways that we can support it and make sure that best practices are developed and shared. And
yeah, I had spoken to a few women. We had a small focus group in the last year. And one of the things that came up was some of the women had to travel to Duluth for, you know, we still provide local prenatal and postpartum care at our clinic in Grand Marais, but then so one woman had gestational diabetes, and so she needed to go down to meet with a specialist and an obstetrician in Duluth quite frequently, and she was talking about how helpful it would have been, or it would be, to have an option to do some of that locally. And of course it's prohibitive to have like an obstetrician come up or something like that to our clinic, but I could imagine a telemedicine option, mm-hmm. you know, if all the pieces came together, you know,
yeah.
that to be able to have a visit with someone in your local community, but it's a provider, a specialty provider from outside of the community.
I think that's a great idea. And, you know, it is growing, and we'll see what it looks like in 5 years or 10 years. I'm sure it'll be totally different, and people using it in that technology in a lot of different ways. There are emerging professions as well that I think could get plugged into existing healthcare structures, like the role of the doula, also the community health worker, and in some cases the community paramedic. These are new or relatively new professions in our healthcare system. Some of them have been around for centuries, like doulas have been around for millennia, so it's you know, not a new concept. But payment of from Medicaid and from insurers is there, and it's being developed and expanded. And so as these roles kind of find their niche within the existing healthcare system, that's another thing that we're trying to encourage, because it might be easier for a community to build programs and services around these professions rather than it always being reliant on a doctor who's trained in everything. And so the community can come together and build these services and programs, hopefully in a way that meets the need of their community more directly.
Hmm. And so I'm familiar with a doula, which is a trained kind of labor support person, mm-hmm. Not someone who's going to deliver a baby, but who's there to provide that emotional and labor support. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the community paramedic and the community health worker are?
Sure. So another aspect of the doula is that they're an educator also. So for the public health perspective, this is really important. The community health worker is also an educator, and they're trained in, connecting with people on a very basic level. Sometimes they're from a community that might not be well served by the healthcare system, and they can act as sort of a cultural liaison between the two. And they're a health educator, so in the case of a doula or a community paramedic who's trained in prenatal care, community health worker who's trained in prenatal care, what they can do is talk to somebody who's maybe going through pregnancy for the first time and really define what normal looks like. It's okay to feel this way, or it's okay to be, this is not a major concern. It happens all the time, and sometimes people really need that assurance and education to know that things are going well, or when things are not, and then they can be referred on to a medical professional. With a community paramedic, especially in rural areas, this is an interesting role because in a lot of cases, paramedics are really sort of there for the emergency situation, and in rural areas that doesn't happen all the time. And so you've got a role who's fairly well trained and knowledgeable about healthcare. And the idea of the community paramedic is that you train them in primary care, and then they can go out into the community, they can go into people's homes and do home visits, especially after a discharge from a hospital, something like that. Make sure that they're following up on their care, they're getting their medication, that everything is safe in the home, and then they can bring that information back to a primary care provider. So with these new roles, they really do sort of fit and try to fill gaps within the system. And with a community health worker and a doula especially, there's a really strong connection there between the medical and the clinical care that people are receiving, and also the public health aspect of delivering care, so that people are educated in what services are available, what's how they can maintain their health, not just their disease. Mm-hmm. And so that there's these roles are really designed to bridge a lot of the sectors within the healthcare system, and with healthcare sort of in a larger sense.
Are there places within the state, rural communities that are currently using the community paramedic or the community health worker or doula?
There are. I know there's a program in Bemidji that is training community health workers. That's at the Northwest Technical College, and with a heavy emphasis on rural. Yes, there are examples increasingly throughout the state where community paramedics and community health workers are working in rural settings. And I think what people find is that after the initial kind of figuring out of what the role is and what they can do, they realize that once they get out in the community and they start to be that kind of cultural liaison or that connection between the healthcare system and a person in community, the healthcare system finds them invaluable. Hmm. They think that they're just, there are examples, especially in the southwestern corner of the state, where they have a lot of programs with community health workers. And they're doing all sorts of creative things to improve the health of their community and make sure that health equity is addressed as well, so that underserved or minority communities don't feel isolated. They have a connection to the healthcare system through the community health worker. It's a really good model, and I think the more that people and communities use these new roles, I think the more they recognize that they're valuable. Mm.
Do you think that there is, or is there any discussion within your office about out-of-hospital birth or midwifery care or birth center care as one of the many potential solutions? That I don't think there's one solution.
Yeah.
So, but I'm just curious if that is a topic of conversation amongst, you know, along with all these other strategies.
It is. And, you know, we are also the place in state government that looks at workforce and the distribution and demographics of workforce. And so we issue reports on you know, where various professions are practicing, and that is something that we look at too, is midwives and the distribution of them and how well communities within Minnesota are utilizing that role. So, yes, it is something that we think about, and I think where that's appropriate in a community, that's something that we would be happy to support through grant programs or funding or, you know, planning projects and things like that.
Yeah. Well, so we talked, you and I talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but I feel like that this example of the loss of local birthing option kind of heightens the need to pull in that safety net you talked about to close those gaps up. And there are many things outside of the control, for example, of a local community like ours. When our hospital made that decision, it was based on factors outside of our community's control. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like this example of obstetric care in rural communities is a good place where we can look at kind of how our clinical care system, like our hospitals and clinics and emergency services, and then our public health system, which you said is kind of like the home visiting, the education, the supporting people's well-being, mm-hmm. Before and after an illness or disease. It seems like this is an opportunity for those two systems to kind of come a little closer to shore up that net, to close the gaps a little bit. What do you think about that? Do you see ways that, you know, you're here at the Department of Health and you're the public health agency for the state, but you are also the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. So it mm-hmm. seems like you're actually the office that does that, I think.
We try to be, yeah. I completely agree with you that this is, there's always opportunities for communities to come together and try to define and prioritize the services that are the most important for that community. And it's difficult work. A couple things that I would mention are there are ongoing planning efforts, both with hospitals and with local public health. They both are required to go through planning processes. Sometimes they don't line up, but you know, every few years they have to come together, bring the community together, and look at data that they get from the health department or other sources. They look at their local community and what's available, and then they have a discussion about what their needs are, their health needs. It's called a health needs assessment. And I would recommend that the community really get engaged with that process. Sometimes some communities, they bring in everybody, and it's a really welcoming and robust process. Some of them, it's more of a cursory thing that they kind of go through, and just because they have to, the hospital has to every few years. But I would urge the community to take that seriously and to really engage with that process, because it's a great way for the community to talk with the hospital about what the community thinks is the most important. And that can be an interesting process, because sometimes there are competing interests. Yeah. A hospital might look at the community and say, well, this service is, you know, maybe they're looking at what's happening and they realize that they need more mental health services, or they need substance abuse care, or, you know, whatever. And it can be difficult for the hospital to prioritize what services they want to take their limited resources and spend them towards. So that's a really important process where the community can weigh in on that health needs assessment and make sure that it, that the priorities are based on what the community wants. I think communities also play a part in making sure that workforce issues are not kind of a revolving door. And an example of this is maybe if you're the hospital brings in a new physician or a new provider, it can be difficult for that provider to get settled sometimes. And they might be from a different culture, they might be from a different country. That there are a lot of examples of foreign-trained physicians who are practicing in rural areas. And sometimes that adjustment can be difficult, and it's really helpful, and it works very well when the community rallies around these folks and welcomes them. And, you know, their kids are going to be going to school, they're going to be going to religious services and events around town, and I think a community plays a part in making sure that those people are welcomed and accepted as members of that community. That helps with long-term retention. It helps those people stay longer and they settle in the community. I also think, as we mentioned, telemedicine is really interesting. I think that's something that wherever there's an opportunity for a program to start using that technology and to develop best practices and new models, I think that's an encouraging technology that people should look into. And then lastly, I would just say that you know, it's from the state's perspective, I think we have a relatively stable policy and political environment. On the federal level, it's not the case. And there's been a lot of disruption and a lot of it makes it very difficult to plan. It makes it difficult to maintain services when there's so much disruption. And so I think, you know, wherever communities can encourage policymakers to make sure that these programs and policies that we have in place that help rural communities maintain access, that communities are speaking out about that and making sure that policymakers are aware that things like, you know, the critical access hospital program or rural health clinics or FQHCs, whatever your community has and wants to maintain, is that policymakers know that. I think that's really important, especially in times of disruption and kind of difficulties.
That's I really appreciate this entire conversation, but especially those last few points I think are very helpful, just from the point of view of from your point of view, kind of reflected back to community members in a rural area, that to know that those are important things and things certainly within our power to do, you know, to welcome new providers or current providers probably too.
yeah.
And to just let our voices be heard in the political process, that so that we can be factored in along with all of the other competing priorities. But the things you mentioned, you know, are definitely relevant to our community because, as you know, our hospital is a critical access hospital. Our one clinic is a federally qualified community health center. We also have a tribal clinic, of course, up in
right.
Grand Portage. And so our local healthcare system has been very independent forever, mm-hmm. as long as it's been there. But we're also very much impacted by these policy decisions that come from the state and from Washington. So I want to thank you so much, because I didn't know when I came here today how much your work and your office actually play a direct role in our community and up in northern Minnesota. And so I want to thank you for all the things you're doing that I and probably everyone else isn't aware of.
Happy to talk about it, yeah.
To keep our hospital strong and our clinic strong and our local public health system strong. I can't imagine living where we live without having an emergency room or without having family doctors and nurse practitioners or without having community health workers at the, you know, in the tribal clinic and our local public health. And it would be, it's already a challenging place to live with many rewards, of course.
And beautiful.
As well.
Yeah,
it's
an
many
amazing
rewards.
Part of the state.
But I can't imagine living there without the healthcare system that we do have in place. So thanks for all your work to support that.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
If these interviews tonight sparked your interest in sharing your support for our rural clinic, hospital, and public health department, check out WTIP's webpage for links to contact your state and federal elected officials. You know, it's always important for us as rural citizens to share our support for our rural healthcare systems because there just aren't a lot of us in rural America. And so if we don't speak up, our voices aren't heard. Thanks so much for joining me for another edition of Conversations on Health and Well-Being. Until next time, be well and eat your veggies. This is Kristen DiRuta-Wharton for WTIP North Shore Community Radio.